Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My choice this week isn't just one book, it's 10. Yes, it's that time of year again when we longlist the titles in contention for this year's Guardian First Book Prize. That means conjuring a reading list from the thousands of debuts, most by complete unknowns, and many of whom, sadly, will remain unknown. With me in the studio to discuss the lineup are website editor Sarah Crown and Nicholas Rowe, writer and editor on Saturday Review. Hello both.
Hi.
Hi, Claire.
But first, to describe what it means to be plucked from oblivion, here's James Lever, whose autobiography of Cheetah the Chimp has just gone on Wonder of Wonders to be longlisted for the Booker Prize. We asked him what it felt like to have found himself on the Guardian longlist before his book was even published.
After you've written a book, I think it's pretty common for most authors to suffer a reaction against it for a few weeks or several months, because they're just finding out exactly what it is they've fallen short of. You know, looking back on it, the examiner has told you time to put your pen down, and you can't go back to it, of course, because you're already changed. You know that time is up. And so after you've finished a book, you tend to react against it quite strongly. So when I got the call that it was on the Guardian first book long list, I was quite pleased because I was in the middle of boring anyone who would listen about what a lousy book it was, although I still managed to grumble for a couple of weeks. I was quite pleased that at least one reader, or several, had enjoyed it. So yeah, it was a great pleasure. Meet Cheetah was a book that was trying to be a trompe-l'oeil completely. It was trying to smuggle itself into the biography shelves in between Parky and Dawn French, and it was attempting to be a sort of seamless parody without an author name or a dedication or acknowledgements or anything like that, with no clues that it was a book hiding under this slightly irritating front. The Guardian First Book Award is for non-fiction and fiction both, which is one of the reasons I think it's quite a good prize, because I do quite like the comparison of apples and pears in literary awards, especially in an era where you get a lot of crossing over in the form between fiction and non-fiction. The first time you write anything, I mean, before it's been published, you'd be quite rare if you didn't think that there's always a 30% possibility of people just bursting out laughing at it and it disappearing without trace. So it was great to be on the long list.
Now, Nick, James did also say that he'd found Me Cheetah in bookshops under zoology, showbiz memoir and biography. Were you surprised that it would be taken seriously as a novel?
I must confess, it didn't occur to me that it was a novel when I came across it probably about this time last year. But then you think again, and it was narrated by a chimp. So how much more made up do you want?
You can rest your case. Sarah?
Well, I think one of the great features of the First Book Award is that it removes the need to pigeonhole books, because whether your book's fiction or poetry, science or whatever, they're all eligible to enter. And past winners have included a graphic novel, Chris Ware's Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth, and Alex Ross's History of 20th Century Music, The Rest is Noise, as well as novelists like Sadie Smith and Jonathan Safran Foer. So it really sort of crosses the boundaries. And the idea is to highlight books with originality and flair, no matter where they come from.
Do you think there have been any particular strong sections this year, Sarah?
Yes, I suppose if you had to pick one, you'd say this has been the year of the short story, and we've had collections from established practitioners such as Alice Munro, and also lots of promising newcomers. And short stories, I think, have undergone a bit of a renaissance in recent years, and publishers seem to be less nervous of them, hence the sudden abundance. There were several debut collections that could have made the cut. Special mention for me probably goes to Wells Towers' Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. But in the end, we went for Patina Gapper's An Elegy for Easterly.
Could you briefly describe what's so special about it?
Yes, it's a collection of 13 stories, all but one of which were set in Zimbabwe, where Gapper was born. And they grapple with the particular issues facing the country under Mugabe, and not just the larger problems that we're familiar with of hyperinflation and violence and poverty, but the hypocrisy and the secretiveness that his rule has bred, which become part of people's daily lives and their conversations. But they're sort of balanced and shot through with humour and warmth, and they're just a real joy to read.
Now, there are three other works of fiction on the list. Let's start with another book which is on the Booker long list. It's Samantha Harvey's The Wilderness. It's published by Cape. Nick, this book has obviously struck a nerve. What do you think that is?
Yeah, indeed. When we spoke a few weeks ago about the Forward Poetry Prize, we noticed that Alzheimer's had almost become a metaphor of choice for a lot of poets over the last year or so, and this is an Alzheimer's novel. It's about a six-year-old architect who's looking back, or perhaps more accurately, attempting to look back over his life, where sort of memories and facts are shifting in and out of focus, and nothing's really pinned down. We're not even sure how many children he's had. It's real clutching at straws stuff, and it's a remarkable sort of picture of being in this man's disintegrating mind. Very troubling, very effective, and prize juries have loved it. Samantha Harvey was the only British writer on the Orange shortlist this year, and she's also won a Betty Trask and £12,000.
Yes, and if you look on the blogosphere, you can see it's a book that a lot of ordinary readers love. Now, a second novel's very different, and it's one that people seem to either love or indeed hate. It's The Rehearsal by 24-year-old New Zealander Eleanor Catton. It's published by Granta. Sarah, do you love it or do you hate it?
Goodness, I didn't realise she was only 24. Good grief. Well, that makes it even more impressive for me, I think. It takes a very familiar subject, one that's dealt with a lot in literature, of the student-teacher romance. People might know it from things like Zoe Heller's book, Notes on a Scandal. And it approaches it in a completely fresh, clever, exciting way. And it's hugely ambitious and has the sort of confidence that you don't expect from a first-timer, I don't think. Justine Jordan reviewed it for The Guardian, and she said it has the glitter and mystery of the true literary original. And I think she's right, so yes, I suppose I'd say I love it.
A book that glitters in a very different way is our next selection. It's the intriguingly titled The Selected Works of T.S. Spivitt by Rafe Larson. I think that's the right way to pronounce it. Who captivated visitors to this year's Hay Festival with his illustrated account of his obsession with cartography. Sarah, this book provoked a huge bidding war between 10 US publishers last year. That sort of hype can be dangerous for a first book, can't it? Were you taken in by it? Do you think it lived up to it?
Well, I have to say the hype actually put me off because I heard so much about it before it came out, and I thought, oh.
It's a very Guardian position, that,
yes.
Isn't it? Overhyped and over here.
Quite so. And then when I saw the book itself, that kind of put me off a bit more because it's terrifically whimsical looking. You have lots of the author's illustrations and his maps. It's a book about cartography in part. And half of the story is told in margin notes, which just feels to me like a bit of a tired device. But then it had a lot to overcome, but I think it really did. It's actually at root just a fairly rollicking story about a child prodigy who sets off on a sort of quest across America to collect a prize for his maps from the Smithsonian Institute, who mistakenly believe that he's an adult. And yes, a child prodigy very much in the mould of Salinger, with a bit of Dave Eggers thrown in.
I seem to have read an awful lot of first books this year voiced by precocious teenagers. Mm. Is that a general trend?
Well, I think it has been for a couple of years, actually. If you look at things like Ali Smith's The Accidental, which had a female version of this sort of precocious, all-knowing, clear-seeing voice. And then the other side of the coin is something like The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which had the boy who was suffered from Asperger's, and he spoke in a way that was sort of very, very clear and seeing without, you know, but retaining a sort of childlike which I think is very appealing to readers and is definitely present in this book.
I did wonder whether it was something to do with the rise of crossover fiction, this,
yes,
you know, that
be.
we're going backwards in age, we're reverting to teenagers.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because I suppose, you think coming from the other side of the crossover, things like Meg Rossoff's How I Live Now, which was out sort of a few years back and has a similar sort of voice, but is perhaps geared differently. Yeah, it could be something to do with that.
There you go, you heard it first here. Our fourth novel is one of those quiet, unclassifiable books that seems entirely uninfluenced by literary fashion. It's The Girl with the Glass Feet, and it's by 27-year-old bookseller Ali Shaw. He's male, in case you wondered. It's published by Atlantic. Sarah, this is one of the most unusual books I've read this year.
Yeah, it's a very odd, quiet book. It's a sort of fairy tale love story set on a mythical archipelago called St. Hordas Land, which is very frozen and northern and maybe Scottish, perhaps, between a damaged young man and a young woman, Ida McLeod, whose feet are slowly turning to glass.
It could be very fey. Did it get away with it, do you think?
Yes, I think it did by being completely convinced of its own reality. So there was no... There was no nod to the fact that it was an odd world with winged creatures or anything like that. It was an entirely internally coherent universe, and the author approached it with total conviction, which allows you to approach it in the same way, I think.
Mm. And of course, it's a wonderful central metaphor for doomed love, isn't it?
Yes.
It's almost poetic, you could say, which of course neatly brings us to the poetry collection on the list.
Well played.
It's The Missing by Sian Hughes, who describes herself as a lone parent living with two small children in the middle of nowhere. Nick, what did you make of this?
The centrepiece of this collection is Hughes's poem called The Send-Off, which won the Arvon Prize in 2006 and was broadcast on Women's Hour, where it really struck a nerve. It's an elegy for a lost, unborn child, and it raised all sorts of issues about grief and guilt and women's lives and specific stuff like antenatal testing. And the rest of the collection follows on with that kind of toughness. She's very emotionally direct, but although she writes very straightforwardly, more importantly, Hughes does make this material into poetry. This isn't just reportage from the emotional front line. And it's a very impressive debut, which also got onto the Forward first collection shortlist.
Do you think there's a possibility it might be our first poetry winner?
It would be a good winner if it won.
Very tactful, very tactful. Of course, Nick can't really voice an opinion since he's also a Forward Poetry Prize judge. Before any smart Alex point out that Sian Hughes has two other book titles on Amazon, I would point out that we're abiding by the Poetry Book Society's guidelines on the distinction between a pamphlet and a book. A book has to have 48 pages, so there you go. Now, that brings us to the non-fiction on the list. And first up is another short book, actually. It's direct read by surgeon Gabriel Weston, published by Cape. It's one of at least three medical memoirs submitted this year. Nick, what makes direct read stand out?
Weston read English before she moved into medicine and became a surgeon, and it really does show. There's a lot of talk and reflection about poets and writers among some astonishing insights in both the medical practice and the medic's mindset. One reviewer said this had the whiff of ether, which it does, but it also has the sound of blood dripping on a tiled floor. It's very detailed and revealing, and she's very honest about things you don't always associate with surgeons. She notices people's bodies, for instance. She fancies one patient, and she's very good on ambition, how sometimes the patient can come second to pleasing your boss.
Now, direct read could be described as an improvisation on a memoir, that jaded form. Our next book is actually a straight down the line biography. It's The Strangest Man by Graham Farmelow, and it's about Paul Dirac. Now, Nick, who was Paul Dirac?
He's the forgotten star of British physics, and perhaps the reason he isn't better known is, as the title suggests, he was quite an odd man. Niels Bohr, head of the Institute of Theoretical Physics, who might know something about this, called him the strangest man he ever met. These days he'd probably be called a high-functioning or autistic, and his colleagues once invented a spoof scientific unit for the smallest imaginable number of words that someone with the power of speech could utter in company, and a Dirac was one word per hour.
So now there's some quite chewy science in this book. Do you think it's accessible to the general reader?
Yeah, there's only actually one equation in the whole book, and Farmelow does make the most of the life. There's a tyrannical father in there, there's a brother who committed suicide, and the 20s, 30s, 40s were fascinating times, and nowhere more so than in the world of physics.
Yeah, I would point out also that it's another book that's been blurbed incredibly impressively by people like Michael Frayn and Tom Stoppard, but I have to say that they're a bit cleverer than I am, so that doesn't really give me many clues. Anyway, our next long listee is There's No Problem At All With The Following and Understanding. It's A Swamp Full of Dollars by journalist Michael Peel, and it's published by IB Taurus. Nick, this is a work of solid reportage about the terrible corrosive effect that oil has had on Nigeria's morals and economy and everything.
Yeah, this is real boots-on-the-ground journalism, and it's set in the oil-rich Niger Delta, which has become something of a mini-state within Nigeria, and where, alarmingly, so petroleum and polio have both boomed at the same time. This has inevitably provoked some very worrying tensions, and particularly worrying for a Western world, increasingly anxious about where new oil is going to come from. And again, lots of very fancy blurbing from Michaela Wrong, James Meek, Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz have all attested to the timeliness and power of this book.
Sarah, what did you make of this?
I think it's a very refreshing book. It's a very heartfelt book, a work of conscience almost. And it's nice to see longer form journalism making an impression as well. A necessary book, I think.
It makes big connections. It is not just for the sort of West Africa wonk, is it? He actually one of the interviews he does is with banks in England, and that's where the money comes from. They're the people who laundered the money that was sent out to Nigeria. You feel he's really, really gone to the places and asked the questions that need to be asked.
I think that's what's so compelling about it, because it's almost a sort of legitimate conspiracy theory in a way, when you see all the link-ups that actually exist between, you know, banks here and oil companies there. It gives weight to our suspicions that things are being controlled by sort of mystical figures in the background, I think. But and he seeks them out.
It's quite. He holds himself quite tightly, doesn't he, stylistically? He's not given to great lyrical sweeps.
No, he's not. He's not indulgent at all, and that's. I think again, that's what lends power to the book. He gives you the space to draw your own conclusions, which is what journalism should do. So yes, I think it's a very powerful book.
Now, the final title on the list is very different again. It's The Secret Life of Buildings by Edward Hollis. It's published by Portobello. It's a sort of baton race of buildings through history, if you can imagine that. Nick, can you describe it a little more clearly?
It's a very impressionistic account of 13 iconic buildings that include Notre Dame, the Berlin Wall, the Hume Crescent in Manchester, Las Vegas, gambling palaces. And Hollis's essential thesis is not only that nothing lasts forever, but things also transform themselves in the meantime. I mean, the Parthenon was a Christian church for longer than it was a pagan temple. It was also a mosque. It's a gunpowder store.
Is it architectural writing? Is this the future for that sort of writing?
It's difficult to say. It's much about us as it is about the buildings. Because it seems that however solid these things might appear, if we try to pin down a monument at a single point in time, we not only miss out on the cultural story of that building, but we somehow limit our own sort of appreciation of the built environment around us.
Sarah, this is probably the most original book formally on the list. Do you think, you know, is that something that struck you?
I thought, actually, what I was thinking about and listening to Nick talking about it then was that in some ways it draws or it bears comparison with Direct Red, in that it's a memoir of a different kind. And it seems that people are more and more approaching, you know, sort of, I don't know, non-fiction and biography in this sort of weird crossover way. You look at, I don't know, a book like Margaret Drabble's and The Pattern in the Carpet, where she looks at her life through jigsaws. It has a similar sort of feel to it, and I think it's a sort of a cross-genre thing, and I'm really keen on it. I like it a lot, and I really like this book.
Are we looking at the breakdown of genre, or are we looking at the enrichment of genre?
That's a big question. I don't know, I suppose. We've already mentioned Me Cheetah, which crosses genre. We talked about crossover fiction earlier on between sort of children and adult authors. And here we have memoir blending with biography and non-fiction. So possibly, yes, I think people are certainly becoming more inclined to experiment with genre and recognising the potential of doing so.
And readers becoming more sophisticated in reading it as well.
Yes.
People are happy to take this stuff on board, no matter how apparently weird it might be.
Which also suggests that publishers are happier to publish it as well.
And that brings us back to one of the big points about this prize, is it's a reader's prize. So we're going to be putting this out to groups across the country and saying, what do you make of this? And they may hate it, of course, that's always a risk. So that's it for this year's long list. Sarah, I'm going to put you on the spot now and ask if you have a favourite.
It's always very difficult to say because it depends so much on the judges and their preferences, and particularly with a prize like the First Book Prize that doesn't just go for fiction or non-fiction or whatever. This year on the panel there's Martha Carney, the radio and television presenter, political philosopher John Gray, the novelists Tobias Hill and Nadeem Aslam, and the Guardian's deputy editor Kath Viner. Historically, the novelists tend to be more critical of the fiction, so perhaps they might sway the others in favour of memoir or biography, but that's total speculation, really. If I were on the panel, I think I'd go for either The Secret Lives of Buildings or Eleanor Catton's The Rehearsal, but it's not up to me, so we'll have to see.
Nick?
I like Direct Red, but don't forget those Waterstones reading groups you mentioned round about the country, they also have a say, and traditionally they're very exacting and opinionated critics.
Yes, they're absolutely terrifying, aren't they? They usually beard me at the party and tell me what rubbish list it was, but there we go. The actual winner of the prize will be announced in early December. Meanwhile, Nicholas Rowe and Sarah Crown, thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Cawley. Goodbye.